if AI in education was a marathon, we'd be in the first mile. We'd be in the first half mile. AI's ability to generate human-like content, it introduces risks such as misinformation, disinformation, or manipulation, right? It is not a fun time to be talking about education and the US federal government.
Welcome everybody to the AMP211 podcast. My name is Brett Roer, co-host and CEO and founder of Amplify and Elevate Innovation. We have an incredible guest here today, Pat Youngpredit, the Chief Academic Officer at Code.org and one of the true leaders in making sure AI innovation and education is accessible for all, especially in the world of code. Pat, it is such an honor and pleasure to have you here today. How are you doing, sir?
Doing great. It's a beautiful afternoon in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I'm excited for this podcast. Thanks, Brett.
Absolutely. I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Rebecca Boltzmann. Rebecca, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. We're hanging on to those last dredges of summer up here in Canada, so trying to make the most out of that, and just happy to be here, having interesting conversations with interesting people, as usual.
Yeah. So we're going to let our audience hear, listen, learn, hopefully laugh with Pat today. So Pat, for those that have followed your work and have seen how inspiring and passionate you are, you know, you're really on brand with us. You are always amped up to 11. So can you share with everybody, like, what gives you that energy and urgency right now in the field of education? Can you share with everyone your journey, your why, how you see AI innovation changing the field of education and workforce development today?
Okay, there's a lot to cover there. I'll try to be brief, but also be useful for your audience. So folks, I'm going to give you some tips that will help you figure out how did a guy like me get to where I'm at, and maybe how it might inform your own career and passion trajectory. So ultimately, Brett, what I'm about is using what I've been given to do good for others. It sounds like a platitude, but specifically what I mean is I learned how to code on an Apple IIe in fourth or fifth grade. And I got to go to a computer science magnet school in high school and learn some fabulous skills during that time. And then I decided to go into neuroscience for college at McGill, Rebecca, in Canada, in Montreal. And then I taught for 13 years. And throughout all of those experiences, I've parlayed that into where I'm at now, which is Code.org. And so I felt a responsibility to be a computer science teacher and not be a neuroscientist because I wanted to give back to society in a way that reflected what my value add would be, which is I got to learn computer science while a lot of people didn't. So I wanted to make sure that lots of kids got to learn it as well. So I became a computer science teacher. And I pursued that mission beyond the classroom by writing curriculum, going to conferences, representing big companies like Microsoft and Pearson. And that eventually led me to some type of leadership in a growing national community of computer science educators, which ultimately led me to Code.org 12 years ago now. And so a couple of tips for the audience. Number one, if you're a teacher and you're looking for more influence, it's already there, whether it's at your school level, just advocating for your program, especially if you're a computer science teacher. But even if you're a statistics teacher, you should go from one class period to two class periods of statistics. So being an advocate that way, writing curriculum for your district, you know, representing on state task forces, obviously contracting during the summer for companies, small and big, going to conferences, presenting at conferences, and parlaying that into larger influence, which doesn't have to go beyond the classroom, like as a full-time thing, but at least can go beyond the classroom when you are outside of your classroom. And then lastly, when it comes to how I got to where I got, I think it's always a bit about service, Brett, and just not worrying about like growing in my career or like attaining any type of role. It's just like just understanding that, you know, here I am, I've been given what I've been given, and I need to use it to the maximum. And if I use it to the maximum, I will fit naturally where I'm supposed to fit. And that's all I can ask for myself.
I love that. Now, for those of us that don't live in a coding space and people who might be listening to this, explain it to me like I'm five, a little bit about code.org, what they do and what you do there.
Okay. Code.org's mission is to make sure that every student in every school has the opportunity to learn computer science and AI. Now, we're called code.org, but we're actually much more, from the beginning, we've been about much more than just coding. We've been about computer science. And even in the computer science realm, we've been much more about like the larger impacts of computer science as well, whether it's economic or social impacts or personal impacts. Now, with AI, we've been doing AI stuff way before ChatGPT got released in November 2022. But we really ramped it up and we kicked up this initiative in partnership with ISTE, ETS, Khan Academy, and the World Economic Forum. And this initiative is called Teach AI, and it's brought together 44 state education agencies in the US, 30 ministries of education outside the US, and over 100 advisory committee organizations. And that really reflects a lot of Code.org's thought leadership these days, that initiative. And in fact, overall, Rebecca, we're really leaning into much more of an AI forward positioning to our organization. And okay, one last thing. We pursue our mission in four different ways: policy work, awareness work, curriculum and professional learning, which is includes like developing tools as well, like the learning platform, and then just community building work, like the Teach AI initiative.
Well, it sounds like from what you've said, there's a lot of different things that led you to where you are now, and probably a lot of different people, I would expect, that kind of helped you along the way. And one of the things that Brett started in our podcast in season two is inspired by Amy Poehler's podcast. He likes to say nice things about people behind their back, talk nice behind their back. So would you mind telling us a little bit about who some of those people who've shaped your journey are? And let's say some nice things behind their back and hope that they hear this, but give them kind of the flowers that you'd like to give them.
Yeah, I would love to. And, you know, it's interesting. This first person is my high school AP physics teacher. And, you know, what's funny about it, Rebecca, is I actually don't remember his last name right now, but I remember his first name, Rick. And that goes to show you like how impactful he was. Like, he was very personable and he really took the time to develop relationships with his students. He was also president. I mean, he also led the ski club, and he, you know, he's the person who introduced me to skiing and snowboarding and all that. And he took these kids. And actually, when I became a teacher later, I started the snowboard club and ski club at my high school, because I remembered the modeling that he did. And I thought, wow, that would just be awesome if I could do the same thing for kids. But he was the first person who basically cemented in my mind, like, hey, teaching can be cool. It can be okay. It can be fun. It can be exciting. It could still be intellectual. He was great. And I still can't remember his last name right now. But anyway, his first name was Rick. So shout out to him. I connected with him maybe 6, 10 years ago now, just to thank him again. And, you know, and he was still the same guy. He was wonderful. I'm going to flash forward to now. And I think like you, Rebecca and Brett, you guys are thought public intellectuals in the space, right? Some might call you influencers, which is technically true, but you're influencing in a way that makes people smarter and think of new things and have new perspectives, which is wonderful. And so I'd like to shout out two people. Dr. Philippa Hardman. I don't know how, Philippa, if you're listening to this, I actually don't know how influential she is. I don't know if anyone's listening to this knows about her. It's a pretty niche area that she writes about. It's generative AI and instructional design. And it's quite amazing how much you can talk about it and and continue to like bring forth new treasures and ways to think about instructional design and how generative AI supports the process, but also supports the learning science that you know should be reflected in instructional design. And so anyway, I just want to give her a shout out because I just learned so much from her newsletter. And then the second person I want to give a shout out to is my man Stefan Bouchard. He is super prolific. And again, he just unearths, he just shares lots of new angles and ways to think about things. And clearly he's not afraid to express his opinion or an idea that's dissonant with maybe like consensus opinion about AI and education. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate everyone who are like those two, people who go deep into a particular niche area of AI and education and constantly provide value in that space, as well as people who are like Stefan comments on everything, political to instructional or whatever. And I find it all useful. So those are just two of the very many people. And then there's obviously Rick who just got me into education in the first place.
Amazing. And, you know, like you said, you don't know who's going to follow up or learn about them, but that's exactly what this is for. You know, you've just opened up our audience to a whole new world of people who are doing great work in this space. So thank you for that. That was amazing. And shout out to all the Ricks out there who truly shape and guide people.
Oh, Rick Motes. Rick Motes. M-O-A-T-S. Rick Motes. That's it.
There you go, Pat. Good pull. I also, like, I became a history teacher, and my favorite teacher was my 11th grade AP US history teacher. And that summer, I was, like, working a part-time job, and I came home. My dad's like, hey, you know, your teacher called. You got a 5 on the AP exam. And I swear, I've told people, it's like, you could tell me, like, the president called? Because this is, like, not a person who, like, ever on their guard. And I was like, I said, I can't believe I missed this guy's call. You know, you don't have phones. It was a pre-cell phone era for me. So it was just like one of those moments where I'm like, the fact that that guy picked up the phone to call has like, I'll never forget that. And like something I carried forward in public ed myself.
Brett, you know, it just reminded me, I used to do that. What, like when I would catch, like during my off period, randomly, I would just figure out, I'd think about a kid who you could use some encouragement, call their parent up. And obviously their parent getting a teacher call, they're like, oh, what did my kid do? I'm like, no, your kid's doing awesome. I just wanted to share. And they're like, they were so thankful. Like, oh, thank you for letting me know. And the next day I would see the kid come in. You'd see the kid like feeling like extra peppy around you and just kind of like smiling and all that. And I thought, oh yeah, it just took like 2 minutes to do that. And it was so worthwhile. So if you're a teacher, I want you to like pause this podcast and go do that. And I would say if you're a teacher who has kids who are in their careers right now, find them on LinkedIn. Tell them how proud you are of like where they landed, wherever they landed.
I mean, first of all, this has just turned into such an informative, like action-oriented way if you're a teacher to expand your impact and have a personal impact on people. I mean, that's the OG talking good behind their backs, calling mom and dad or grandma and saying, this is your kid's amazing. Like, there's really nothing better you can do to make everyone in that household feel like so special that it validates all the work of being a parent as well. So well done. Great advice. I hope everyone listening in the audience literally pauses right now, does something amazing, and then comes back. So, Pat, I mean, you shared literally who inspired you on your journey, who's continued to push your thinking, and the fact that you now have this amazing coalition, I believe you said in 44 states and internationally. Could you share some of the most promising federal or state guidance that you've recently seen that could meaningfully shape how AI is adopted in classrooms? And what are still areas that are maybe lacking out there that you hope to see in future iterations?
It is not a fun time to be talking about education and the U.S. federal government. When I say fun, it's not fun, meaning there are lots of things that lots of educators disagree with coming out of our federal government. One thing that you all can hopefully feel more positive about is the stuff coming out of the federal government related to AI education. Starting in April 2025, there was this executive order that came out from the White House. And remember, an executive order is an order to the government because the White House controls the government directly as like they're the manager of the government. And so this executive order commanded the government to do many things, including create a task force that brought together the departments of labor, commerce, agriculture, and education, which, by the way, is a really big deal that an education thing included those other groups at the secretary level, because it specified that. Then they created this presidential AI challenge, which has already gotten launched by the first lady, actually. And that presidential AI challenge not only includes students and teachers, but it has a track that has students actually creating AI technologies themselves. So not just those competitions where kids like imagine what they might do with AI and write up a PDF or shoot a fake video or whatever. But no, like they actually have to create a something that actually impacts a community. Those are like words from the challenge. And then that executive order also called on the U.S. Department of Ed to allocate grants to support AI education. And what's great about that is it's not just about the use of the tools, it's about understanding how AI works and the computer science behind it. So in many ways, that executive order has already followed through on a lot of its, you know, a lot of what it commanded. And that's what's happening at the federal level. And there will probably be other things as well. And, you know, I'm excited to be a part of that and help make sure that it helps students and teachers all over the U.S.
I think you're right. There's a lot of things that are really uncertain that are happening and some really good things. So thanks for pointing out the good things.
Hey, Rebecca, I have a question for you. Rebecca, what's happening in Canada?
Oh, that is a loaded question.
Is there like any federal government guidance on AI? And is it all just provincial? Which province is leading the way?
That's a great question. And I do the majority of my work in the U.S. actually, but it's probably kind of similar, but in Canada, each province is in charge of all things education themselves. And there hasn't been anything at the provincial level, at least not in Alberta where I live. I haven't seen a lot of stuff coming out. Most districts I know are just trying to bring in their own people for PD or highlight their champions and just kind of the same things that everybody else is trying to figure out, but hasn't been super far ahead. I'm sure there are people working on things, but I haven't seen anything spectacular yet at an organization level.
I don't have a Canada-wide view, but I have been to New Brunswick, and I know, and they are part of Teach AI, and I know what they're up to. I can't compare it to other provinces, but I think what they are doing is quite positive, actually. It's a mishmash of guidance and teacher professional development and task forces and stuff like that, even combining their English and French sides. So it's really cool.
I'll have to look into that. I have an interesting place to sit because I live in Canada. I do all my research on AI ethics in the UK, and then I do a lot of my professional work in the United States. And so I'm always kind of looking to see what the different mindsets are, the different adoption strategies. It's very interesting to pay attention to how everybody's approaching it differently, which actually kind of leads into my next question for you, which is kind of about AI ethics, which is my area. We hear about it a lot, right? The phrase being thrown around about AI ethics or ethical AI, which are used interchangeably, but arguably are not the same thing. But I'm just wondering, from an AI ethics standpoint, what do you see as some of the biggest ethical risks facing education in general right now connected to AI? And do you have any guidance or suggestions or ideas on what some of the best way to tackle some of those things might be?
Let me start by talking about this AI literacy framework that the European Commission, OECD, Code.org, and a variety of global experts have been working on. And by the way, if anyone listening to this has been a part of any of the reviews, we've had over like 560 submissions to the review form and over 1,000 focus group participants across close to 30 focus groups over the summer. If any of you are listening, just thank you for your input. A lot of you all actually talked about ethics and wanting to see ethics in the framework. And lo and behold, there's lots of ethics in the framework, but probably not the way that people would expect it. Meaning if you did a control F find for the word ethics, you might see it 7 times or something like that, but you're not going to see it 50 times. And that's because the way we approached it was to actually melt it, like not use the word ethics to talk about ethics, but actually talk about the ethical actions. Actually, Rebecca probably knows this. There's a lot of, what's the word? Just like talking about ethics and not a lot of depth to it. So let me give you an example. This framework of ours has a competence that says, evaluate whether AI outputs should be accepted, revised, or rejected. Something very simple like that, right? And the idea there is that learners would recognize that AI's ability to generate human-like content, it introduces risks such as misinformation, disinformation, or manipulation, right? And so learners must apply critical thinking to execute this competence to detect misleading outputs and adopt a responsible attitude to ensuring AI is used ethically. I only use the word ethics one time right there at the end, yet all of that is about ethics, and all of that requires an understanding of the ethical risks, misinformation, disinformation, and frankly, the thing, in the answer to your question, the thing that I think is the greatest ethical risk right now is manipulation, especially in the form of limiting people's perspectives or especially like validating people in a way that is not healthy. And I'm talking about AI companions, honestly, when I'm talking about that. And so luckily there is legislation addressing some of the ethical concerns I just mentioned. Colorado and Texas in the US have passed EU AI Act style bills at the state level. And they've banned certain uses of AI, and they're making sure that AI can't be used to discriminate against folks and things like that.
Very interesting. So I think the way that I kind of think about it, and I could be off, I think about sort of the big AI ethics grand principles, right? Transparency, human autonomy, and then, like you've mentioned, those ethical AI actions underneath them. And there's some of those that individuals can be taking. There's some of those that organizations should be taking. For individual teachers out there, what do you think the most important ethical AI action they can take on an individual level might be, the next best thing for a teacher to do in terms of an ethical AI step?
I'm going to take one of the things that you said, transparency. So when we talk about ethical AI design in the framework, we talk about fairness, transparency, explainability, accountability, respect for privacy, and legal compliance. When it comes to transparency and ethical AI design, that leans a little more technical and all that. What I think teachers can do is be transparent about their use and know enough about AI such that they can explain what they're doing with AI and how AI is doing things for them in a way that doesn't anthropomorphize AI. So it's both transparency and accuracy in communicating how AI works and what it's doing for you. If they can do that, they're being open and transparent and showcasing to their kids, like, hey, AI is not magic and it's okay to use it, but hey, there are positives and negatives, pros and cons, trade-offs, et cetera.
I think that's a great point. That modeling ethical AI use, I think, is so important because we've seen some of that discrepancy come up where, the kids aren't allowed to use it in university and then they get upset and they find out teachers are using it and they have the outrage connected to that. So I think that's a great answer.
I love that outrage. Rebecca, I cannot wait to be in front of a bunch of kids and someone raises their hand and says, how's it fair that teachers can use AI and we can't? Because I love questions like that, because on the surface, it sounds like something to get like mad about. But kid, a teacher's role and a teacher's place and responsibilities is vastly different than yours. All right. So like AI is not a use it, not use it kind of situation. It's a very contextual thing, right? And even the teacher, it's not like they should just use it for everything. There are certain things they should use it for and certain things they shouldn't use it for, in the same way that applies to you. So it helps us get beyond like these very non-nuanced blanket kind of conversations of AI bad, AI good, or use it, don't use it. And so like, and I love, obviously as a former teacher, I love correcting kids. So I can't wait till a kid tries to pull that on me.
Yeah, there's so much nuance to it, right? Because a lot of those kids probably throwing those accusations are ones who from day one were told it's cheating, don't use it. And there was none of the nuance involved in the conversation that started them on the path, which is why they have a binary mindset about it, which is then why they feel that it could be unfair. Anyway, I'll toss it over to Brett. I could talk about this all day, but doesn't make for always an engaging, interesting.
No, I disagree. As someone who has heard Rebecca get to speak with really some of the leading minds in AI and ethics, this is my favorite part. Like, where else in history are you going to get a chance to see this in innovation and technology happening in real time and then listening to great minds talk about it? Like, I think if people are nerding out, that's why they come here. I hope this is it. Like, this is the secret sauce. Pat, you know, you've given really great advice to teachers. And, you know, as a former leader and as a former teacher, one of the biggest challenges is it doesn't matter, like 20 years ago to today, teachers never feel prepared for their first day in the classroom. Now they're in the age of AI, and it's even more feeling like you're not ready for your students, the challenges, right? So with all the work you're leading and all these coalitions that you have, you're building, what should teacher prep programs and PD evolve to like right now so educators are ready to teach with AI, they feel empowered, and again, they have that nuance and gray area expertise or enough of it to feel confident in when to use it, when not to use it, and how to talk about it.
We need to have a let me start off with some perspective. We are still, if AI in education was a marathon, we'd be in the first mile. We'd be in the first half mile. And what I mean by that, and so even like the people who are leading minds and leading the charge in their school systems, they're at the half mile mark, and people who haven't done anything are at the 0 mile mark. We're all bunched up, even though it feels like some people are being left behind, or people feel left behind and everything's moving so fast. Everything might be moving so fast, but we're still at the beginning of all this. We have so much more to learn, lessons to learn, research to be done, etc. And many other technical achievements that will happen over the next few years. And so with that perspective for teacher prep, I would say rather than trying to figure out what all the best practices are and figure out how to mush it into your curriculum, I'd say just start off with some organizational learning opportunities. Show and tell. That's it. Just bring people together in a real professional learning community to experiment in personally relevant, professionally relevant ways. Share that with others and talk about the trade-offs, the pros and cons. Have these discussions together. That is the minimum that a teacher prep program can do right now. There are many teacher prep programs that are doing nothing, though, because like many university programs, you know, people have been teaching the same thing for 5, 10, 15 years. They have their shtick, right? And while digital literacy technology might be an aspect of that teacher prep program, and AI might even make, you know, one class for 2 hours, I haven't gotten the sense that there's this huge upswell of AI education teacher prep programs. And you know what? And again, my point is that, and that's okay as long as you're doing something, as long as you're starting the conversations with these young teachers, because there's just that we don't need to wait until all the research questions have been answered to finally adjust the curriculum. We can get people just learning with one another.
Yeah. I actually have a son who's in his last year of university to be a teacher, and in his student teaching, he'll have good teachers that will show him how they're using AI, but at the school, it's absolutely forbidden still. In fact, to the point where he lives in constant fear that he's going to be wrongfully accused of using AI by an AI detector, which is unfortunate. And we're in that messy middle. So, you know, I have to explain to him, you play by the rules of the game that you're playing, and you But that kind of leads into my next question as to kind of where does the responsibility for all of this lie? Is it in these teacher prep programs? Is it, do individuals need to take responsibility for just teaching themselves? Do they need to wait for their district to do it? Where does the responsibility for this lie? Is it, are we waiting for the government to send down curriculum and send PD dollars specifically for this? I'm curious about your opinion on this because we had a conversation with a guest the other day who had a different opinion than I did. And so I'm curious about yours.
Oh, I'm curious too, because I can only imagine one answer, Rebecca. Yeah. And I would love to hear an alternative to this one answer. But the answer is it's a shared responsibility amongst all of those stakeholders, right? There is no one group that should just be responsible. Not the developers, not the parents, not the teachers, not the students, not the researchers, you know, and not the administrators. It should be a shared responsibility. And there might be different starting points, right? It might be the teacher leader in a school building who takes it upon themselves to be the AI go-to person for staff development. It could be the district superintendent who went to some conference, national conference, and got super excited because they saw Rebecca speak on stage, and they bring that back to their district and say, hey, we're going to be super AI forward. It could be so many things, right? And all those starting points are okay. But it ultimately needs to be a shared responsibility, including policymakers as well. Policymakers, the legislators, and certainly the developers. And I would say, if anything, Rebecca, the developers, when it comes to education, probably don't have enough pressure being put on them to put out things that are good for learning. Yeah. So everyone else probably has enough pressure on them, but the developers, not so much. That's our capitalist society, and that's our current situation when it comes to regulations as well. Luckily, groups like Google, Microsoft, they're actually doing it on their own. Like Google doing some really deep research into learning and creating their own models created just for learning. Microsoft Research has put out models just for math education. They're just doing it, you know, you could say that they're doing it to make a buck, but they don't have to be focusing on education in that way. No one made them.
Yeah, again, could listen to this all the time. I love the fact that you're really bringing to everyone plays a shared role in this, but thank you for highlighting some of the orgs that, you know, they have many reasons why they do what they do, but one of them hopefully is trying to do right and give us the guidance and support that might be lacking.
Anthropic with Claude, I think it's Claude Code or something. Like, there's this feature where it doesn't just do the coding for you, it explains it as well. Like, they didn't have to include that. It could just code it for you, because that's usually what most professionals want. They don't need an explanation, but they included that explanation thing because they understand that there are still learners who might use that thing, and these kids still need to learn what coding actually is.
Yeah, that's a really good point, as people talk about what skills are you going to need in the future, but the like learning how to think about coding might be a new thing you need to do, not necessarily actually do the coding, but you need to be able to fact on it. You need to be able to explain it to other people. Yeah, so that's a really great point. And hopefully, again, you know, you've already shared with teachers what they need to do. Now, edtech companies and other large orgs that are builders, listen to Pat. Make sure you can make thinking visible and exciting and engaging, even if they never have to actually use that skill because there's an AI tool that can do it for them. Pat, I mean, you're just taking over the show, so let's make it official here. So at the end of season one, we had a new initiative for one of our guests, and we just turned over the reins to the AMP211 podcast to our guests. So for the next few minutes, you are now the host. And so for me and Rebecca, what is one question you would like to ask us about AI education innovation right now?
This is such a wonderful feature. I missed this in the prep, Brett. Otherwise, I would have gotten super excited about it, because this is like, as you've seen, I am totally, I ask you all questions organically anyway. Okay, so if folks have made it this deep into the podcast, they deserve something special, all right? They don't, and more than likely, they have been exposed to AI education stuff, and maybe only half of what we've talked about is new to them. So since it's my podcast now, I want to talk about things that we don't know about Rebecca and Brett, like significant fun things. All right. So, you know, y'all, some of y'all on this in this audience been listening to Rebecca and Brett for a while. You might not know these things about them. You certainly don't know these things about them. We're about to learn a little bit, you know, some new stuff about them. Starting with Rebecca. Rebecca, what's like a new fun? What's something these folks don't know about you that's like super fun? Could be a hobby, whatever.
I am about to have my 25-year wedding anniversary because I married my high school sweetheart when I was 18 and had three kids by the time I was 21. And so I've kind of have a different kind of academic and learning path than most people, but I kind of plugged along and I'm from a town of like 3,500 people, full of nobody who cares about technology. So I'm a bit of an anomaly, which is probably why I'm a little bit of a nerd, but I'm trying to think of anything else kind of interesting. I've ran a whole bunch of marathons and half marathons and triathlons for fun. So that tells you just how boring of a person I am.
Rebecca, you ever heard of this guy named David Goggins?
I think I have.
Okay. All right. All right. Yeah. And when you say marathons and multiple marathons, I think of
not
David Goggins.
Like, not on David's level. I don't do ultra and supers. That's definitely for sure.
Oh, I didn't even know there was a thing called a super.
Is
an ultra?
Great question. I actually was, this is reminding me of a podcast I listened to this morning. It was talking about the difference between yacht sizes, like a mega yacht and a super yacht and a regular yacht. And the answer is, I'm not cool enough to know, but I'm pretty sure one of them involves running 100 miles, which means I will never do it. But I'm sure Brett is way more interesting than I am.
Okay, Brett, but you've had some time to think about it. What's the interesting thing?
My mind went a different direction than Rebecca's. So I'm going to tell a little story about how I became a teacher in Brooklyn. So I was a college student at Hunter College in New York City. I was a bartender. I worked 12-hour shifts and I was student teaching. So literally, you'd student teach from approximately 8 to 3, and then you'd work a bartending shift from 4 to 4, 2 days in a row. And so I don't actually remember all of that. Yet, towards the end, as you start to apply for jobs, I went to a hiring fair, and they called me back for an interview, and so I wore a suit. The suit I chose to wear was in the lobby of the East Village apartment I lived in. It said, take these, you know, free. And I went and I got it tailored to fit me. And I wore this white suit to a job interview with a panel of about 20 educators, right? So they had like APs, students, parents, the principal. And they hired me and brought me back for follow-up interviews. But for almost 20 years now, it was 2005, they still will send a random text picture of me in that white suit. I also had hair. You can't see it, audience, but I had hair down to my shoulders. I had glasses. I would get mistaken all the time for Julian Lennon, who at the time he's John Lennon's son, and he lived in the East Village, and people would come up to me in the bar, and they'd be like, are you Julian Lennon? I'm like, do you think if I was the son of John Lennon, I'd be like slinging your drinks? No, you'd be slinging my drinks. So that is the story of the white suit, and that literally, if that white suit had turned off that educational community, that was the most transformative place I could have worked. And now to get serious for a second about that journey, before I was allowed to go to that hiring interview, I wore the white suit and sat just with the principal. And what she did was she was running around. It was her first graduation. And I didn't even get into her office yet. She just stops me in the waiting room and goes, you want to work here? I'm like, yeah. She goes, okay, this school is 99% black and brown boys because it was an automotive school. Why do you want to work here? And I've always shared, like, I cannot imagine what I could have said as a 22-year-old that would have made her say, yes, this is the right person. But I'm really fortunate I did, because I think that really changed my entire worldview, perspective, and the trajectory of my life, like how important it is to really meaningfully care about the people you're serving and the community that if you're fortunate enough to let you in. So hope that was a little background about, I don't know how they hired me or why they hired me, but I'm forever grateful and indebted to that community.
That's a great question. Yeah, that principal is not messing around. They're moving and shaking. They just want to get to the point. And yeah, that's a great question.
Thanks. And I want to give some flowers to somebody he was a guest on this, Marlon Stiles. He was a former superintendent out in Ohio, you know, really well-regarded ISTE distinguished district and leader. And he's testified before Congress. And he actually spoke with Richard Coulat on a panel at AASA I'd never heard him speak. And he said specifically, if you could talk about innovation all you want, this right before AI came out. If what you are doing in your districts is not impacting the trajectory of Black boys, I don't want to hear about your success. If you can't help the most underserved population, then it's not really innovation or the outcomes that truly are going to change society. So I just want to share that, like, that's someone who I will never forget sitting there hearing that and saying, why aren't people saying that part out loud? That's so important to me when we talk about innovation.
I want to hear yours, Pat. I want you to tell a story here that nobody else really knows. Make it good. No pressure.
Well, I'll make it good, but it'll be really nothing anyone will expect. This is a story about being courageous and shooting your shot. So I was a senior in high school. And definitely play this back for my friends. They know this story. Some of them already know where this is going. They're probably laughing right now after listening to this. I was a senior in high school, and you know, you're walking the halls. These halls are busy in high school, and there's this girl who's constantly smiling at me when I walk by her. And you know, in the schedule, you know, you walk certain ways and you see certain people all the time. Every time I see her, she's smiling at me. I'm like, at some points, I'm like looking around, like, what? Why is she smiling? I don't know her, you know. And after a while, I'm thinking, okay, maybe she likes me or something like that. And I thought, okay, that's cool. And I knew that she was younger than me. She was either a freshman or a sophomore at the time, and I was a senior. But I thought to myself, okay, well, she's smiling at me, you know, let me find out what she's about. So we end up in the bus loop one afternoon, and I see her. I go straight up to her, and I introduce myself, and then she introduces herself, and I go straight to the point, and I go, hey, would you like to go out sometime? And now, just to get to that point, now you have to realize I'm a senior, she's a freshman or a sophomore. It turns out she was a freshman, and like I didn't need to do that. I didn't. There are many other people of my age that I could have talked to or whatever, and I wasn't like telling her like, "Ooh, I like you, be my girlfriend." I just wanted to like get to know her. That's it. And by the way, at that time, that wasn't a thing that people did. Like, this wasn't like the 50s and like you go out for a date for an ice cream or something. Like, there weren't many guys at that point who were just like taking someone out just to like get to know them. You know what I mean? Like, and so anyway, I did that. And this was her response. She said, aren't you a senior? And I'm like, yes. And she goes, well, I'm a freshman. So that means that you must be really desperate. And I was like, what? I was like, girl, what are you talking about? Like I'm trying to do you a favor. That's what I was thinking in my head. I'm just trying to get to know you. Like, you're the one smiling at me. Why are you smiling at me? Anyway, I'm thinking about all these things real fast. And then I just respond, no, I'm not desperate. And then I just walk away. So anyway, my point is that it actually did take courage for me, a different type of courage to do that. And that type of behavior, like just shooting your shot, being straightforward, being interested in people, has actually served me a bunch over since senior year of high school.
Did you ever go on the date?
Oh, no, we didn't go on the date. No, she said I was desperate. Like, I just walked away. I just said no.
I was waiting for the plot twist, like you guys got married or something. But
no, that was it. I never seen her again after that. It was probably like the last 2 or 3 weeks of senior high school. So
I'll bet she's sorry now. If you're listening to this, I hope you're sorry you missed out.
Yeah, hopefully you reflect on that time and think, oh, silly freshman me. Like,
missed your shot.
I know. Yeah. So anyway. And I was, yeah, and I just appreciate how senior me kind of dealt with that rejection. I just said straight up, no, I am not desperate, and then walk away. That's it.
Good for you. That's it. That's actually a really good growing experience to have at that time of your life, too. It makes you realize you can shoot your shot anywhere. I think that's great. It took me way longer than that to learn that lesson. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I was saying at the beginning, y'all. Like you're given these things. And when I say given, it's not like, I don't know where that came from, right? Like upbringing or my friends. I don't know what, but I'm given these things. So therefore I should use these things to the best of my ability to serve people. And so what Pat does now is actually a lot of executive influence and schmoozing. And I'm actually quite introverted, but because of those types of experiences, I have these tools in my toolbox, these habits, right? These things that are not too big a deal for me to do. And I deploy them for the sake of education.
I know Rebecca also, right? I met Rebecca while she's keynoting in front of, you know, hundreds of leaders and teachers and educators. And yet she sometimes also, and we're on a podcast together, and she sometimes mentions that she's quite introverted. And Pat, I think what you said about like using what you have to serve others, I think Rebecca and I, like, I find a lot, if we think it's for the right reasons, we are definitely willing to be an extrovert. Like, I'm willing to be shameless in asking people if it's going to help kids or a community. But like, I am like the most timid person if like I need like another napkin from a waiter. Like, I don't want to bother anybody. But if it's for the right reasons and for others, then it's like, of course we're going to do this. So I just want to make sure, like, Pat, that's so incredible that like you use them when you need to use them, but you also are doing it with like purpose, and it seems to be having a really big impact in the world of education. So thank you for always going above and beyond there. Rebecca, we got another place where we'll give Pat a little autonomy here. I feel like he's talked a lot about really great advice for classroom teachers, and we always want to kind of give advice to other demographics. So we got 11-year-olds, like if you're an 11-year-old today on the M211 podcast, or you're a recent college graduate, so maybe a double 11, like 22. What's the best advice you would give to an 11-year-old or a 22-year-old today, right now, about the future and their opportunities?
Oh, great. Let me a little segue. There's some kind of phenomenon called like the Kroger phenomenon or something like that. Well, y'all might know it, where you like get exposed to an idea and then you see that idea everywhere. Something like that. I forgot what it's called.
Yeah. Have you seen Focus with Will Smith? If not, put it on your list. It's fantastic.
I have, but anyway, so I'm having that situation right now, y'all, because I just did a LinkedIn post just today about someone in Louisiana who runs a group called the 11-11 Philosophers Group. I've never seen 11 portrayed that way ever. And I tried to figure out like what that's about. It might mean something. And then now here we are, obviously amped to 11. And I didn't know that you all would use this 11 thing this much, even to the level that Brett just said, like 11-year-olds and 22-year-olds. And this whole 11 thing is like growing on me. Like if I had to pick a number for like a jersey, 11 now feels good. You know what I mean? I never would have thought about it before. Like it's so thank you for that, Brett. For 11-year-olds, that's my son's age, actually, my youngest son's age. So he's in fifth grade. And for fifth graders, oh, man, they just want to have fun. What kind of advice would I give to an 11-year-old that they would actually follow or even, like, process? Okay. I would say, look, save your money, kid. Like, you don't need to buy these little $5, $10 things. Save your money to, like, build it up for, like, a Switch 2 or, like a pair of shoes or something. Like, just don't just like burn money when you get it. And I guess that's the idea of like being more patient or like pushing out satisfaction to a later date. Long suffering. And then I would say for a 22-year-old, this is a kid who is about to enter the workforce. Oh, okay. I got some good stuff for you all, because I got this advice from someone else, Matt Siegelman at the Burning Glass Institute. Burning Glass Institute does a lot of labor data analysis stuff, and it's really super useful. And I asked Matt the same question. I said, Matt, what should I tell young workers? He said, they should look at resumes and look at the skills that the resumes have in common with one another, put them through ChatGPT or whatever, and create like a set of skills that a lot of the jobs that they want have in common. And then start working on demonstrating those skills immediately while they're not even in the job market yet. And that's how they can kind of almost shape their resume and their experiences towards skills and not jobs. and it's a little more adaptable in approach. And especially if these job descriptions are starting to have AI skills, you should already be kind of working on them already. And I thought that was a pretty tactical way of thinking about preparing yourself for the workforce when you don't know. Yeah, just focus on skills versus like the job title.
That's a very 2025 answer. Well done. You are on the zeitgeist. I think you've given advice to literally the current adults in the world, the future adults in the world, and the current students like your son. So I think our last question for you, Pat, is kind of an extension on talking good behind people's backs. But again, it's Ocean's 11 now, right? You're Danny Ocean. You get the chance to assemble like the crack squad, the people who are going to have a unique set of skills who can help you change the trajectory of education in the way that you think is best for society. Who are you bringing along on that journey? Doesn't have to actually be 11 people. And feel free to take your time in thinking through some people you want to make sure others know about who are doing this great work that you would trust to do that.
I'm going to give you a mishmash answer, meaning I'm going to talk about some of the people I currently work with. And I'm going to, because they're top of my mind, yeah, name some people who I don't work with. But I mean, who I do work with, I know them and all that, but we don't work in the same organization. I'm going to give a shout out to our content and research development manager, Veronica Ellis, who recently ran her first global AI education expert group meeting in Paris. This is a group that is informing the development of that AI literacy framework I talked about earlier. And Veronica had never done something like that before. She did a lot of prep, a lot of rehearsal. I grilled her in numerous ways with scenarios and all that. And she worked on those scenarios and figured out ways to kind of make sure that she could continue, like a lot of herding cat scenarios, right? And keeping people from derailing the conversation or dealing with, you know, people who might say something like off the wall or whatever, and how she would handle the facilitation of this experience. And the experience went awesome. And just like working, what I appreciate about her is her openness to work on something and improve, not feel like she has to prove something on her own. Her coachability, she plays tennis, so it's kind of built into that. And I play tennis too, so we use a lot of tennis analogies when we talk about professional development, her professional development. So yeah, she's just great. So Veronica, you're wonderful. I'd also like to shout out our CEO, Hadi Partovi. Hadi has given a lot to this organization and the CS education movement. And Hadi is on paper, one of those like rich tech people who are now trying to influence education on paper. That's the category he's in, but he's very different than that. For many, many years, he was the hardest working person at Code.org. So he didn't like start it as a vanity project. He was like very for real. Like, I want to make sure that every kid has the opportunity to learn computer science. And he blood, sweat, and tears, he put into it for years and years and years and years. And only recently has he taken like a step back to, you know, just work, you know, just have a personal life. And so I just want to celebrate him, because having someone like that who is ambitious, who's using what he's been given, like he's very tech-minded. And so I've learned a lot of different ways to approach problems. Yeah, just having someone like that is on a team is excellent. Obviously, because he has a lot of resources and his network has a lot of resources. And that allowed us to do great things fast at Code.org. So those are two people. I mean, gosh, if I had to hit 11, y'all would be here forever. So let me just try to touch on one more person. And I'm going to try to think of someone else who I do not technically work with right now, but I would put them on my solving AI and education team. You know what? I'm gonna holler at my homegirl Karen Brennan at Harvard University. Harvard Graduate School of Education Karen Brennan leads the Creative Computing Lab. She teaches probably one of the most popular HUGSE, Harvard Graduate School of Education courses related to like education technology or something like that. I forgot what it's called. It might be called Learning Design and Technology, or is that the name of the program? Anyway, people love her for good reason. It's always useful to have someone who's super smart, super knowledgeable about the space, but who's done really practical work, like cranking out curriculum out of her lab, but also working on tools as well. And just really just a person who really brings people together, isn't afraid to debate and dissent, is always like a value add. But, researchers, like, she never like lords her knowledge over people. And it's just very inviting. It's very educational. And that's why I bring Karen on to every project I can bring her on to, because she's just absolutely wonderful. And I can feel very confident putting her on my Ocean's 11, because so many people feel the same way about her. Like, so it's not just Pat thinking that. So if y'all don't know Karen Brennan, she ain't gonna be like the flashiest professor or anything like that, but you should get to know her work. And if you ever get to, the point in your life where you want to go to graduate school for education and in ed techie something something, I highly recommend the Learning Design in Technology program at Harvard Graduate School of Education.
That was incredible. And yes, you're right. I don't know if our listeners, we would put on an extended play for the all 11, but I mean, this is amazing just to get the sampling into who's doing amazing work. Pat, that was how we end. This has really been such a like inspiring, informative conversation. So just want to again, thank you for putting your all into this and really giving some wisdom out there to everyone in the world of education. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, Brett, Rebecca, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also, listeners, you didn't hear this at the beginning, but offline, Pat said we have an audacious goal to make this the most popular education podcast episode ever. So now that you've listened to it and you know it's amazing, make sure to share it with every single person you have ever met. And with that, I want to say thank you for listening to the M211 podcast. Have a wonderful day.